right. Caught me a little off guard there, David, but thank you. Thank you for those songs tonight. I appreciate that. Always enjoy being able to sing God's praises again in the day. When I was in college, I didn't have a whole lot of money. And one of my favorite places to shop was down the street. It was called the Dig Store. Those of you who aren't familiar with what that is, it was a room probably about the size of the overflow over here. And you would walk in, and in that room, all over the floor, were clothes. Probably, if you ever found the bottom, it was probably about knee-deep of nothing but clothes, just piled there. And you could go through, and you could go into this room, and you could dig through all of the clothes, all of the shirts. It was a great place to shop for a poor college student. Shirts were like 10 cents. If you found a good pair of pants, they were like 20 cents. And it was a bargain, and I loved it. That's where my college wardrobe came from. Even some of the sports jackets that I have hanging in my closet right now came from this store. They're nice jackets just laying there on the floor for anybody to pick up. And they cost me less than a dollar. And as a college student, you can't beat that kind of stuff. That's how I got through college. When I was growing up, I loved my mom's cooking. It was really good, except for her mashed potatoes. Don't tell her I said that. I liked everything that she made except for that. But my dad and I had this thing where we always said that mom's cooking was better the second time around. You know, the first time that we ate it, it was good, but after you let it sit in the refrigerator for a day or two, and then you had the leftovers, it was even better. I don't know why it was that way. Susanna's cooking is always good, so don't think I'm saying that. But the leftovers, I mean, if we were really honest with ourselves, how many of us in this room grew up on hand-me-downs and leftovers? Show of hands. That's what gets us through. Without hand-me-downs and leftovers, I would have been a naked, starving little baby boy. And in so many instances, these things are okay. It's okay to have the hand-me-downs. It's okay to have the leftovers because it's what gets us through the rough patches. It's sometimes what gets us through our college days. It's actually what's been keeping me alive for the last few days while Susanna's been in Chicago. But for some things, there's just some things that shouldn't be used again. Some things that you can't do as leftovers, that you can't do as hand-me-downs, such as Band-Aids or paper napkins. You wouldn't want to reuse your mouthwash or your Q-tips. Or my favorite was the ABC gum. You guys know what that is? It's already been chewed. You don't want to have gum the second time around. French fries are not very good the second time. If you don't eat them while you're there in McDonald's, you can't really take them home and pop them in the microwave and hope that they're going to be good again. And when you're having a dinner, you don't really invite your friends over to have leftovers, do you? Unless you have teenage boys, and then boys don't care. But you don't invite your friends to come over to the house and say, hey, we're going to clean out the fridge. You know, it's leftover night. It's going to be a party. And you would never, ever think about bringing leftovers to a church potluck, would you? That'd just be weird. But why is it that so many of us try to serve leftovers and hand-me-downs to the God of the universe? There we go. Why is it that so many of us try to give second best to God? I mean, do you realize how absolutely absurd that sounds? Like somehow, as people, we feel like calling ourselves Christians is good enough. And to say that I wear the name Christ or I am a Christian is good enough to skate by. But as I came to our reading this week, as I was reading through, I came to this little book called Malachi. It's the last book in our Old Testament, probably not the last one written, and I'm going to be real honest with you. I was really stunned when I started to read it because I had never ever taken the time to read it before. I couldn't believe what I was reading. We come to chapter 1. In the very first few verses, we find God saying stuff like this. Where did it go? It's there. There it is. Chapter 1 says, "When you bring a blind or sick or lame animal to sacrifice to me, do you think that there's nothing wrong with that? Try giving an animal like that to the governor. Would he be pleased with you or grant you any favors?" We all know the answer to that question, right? "Now you priests, try asking God to be good to us. He will not answer your prayer, and it will be your fault. The Lord Almighty says, 'I wish one of you would close the temple doors so as to prevent you from lighting useless fires on my altar. I am not pleased with you. I will not accept the offerings that you bring to me.'" Can you imagine being an Israelite at this time and reading these words? I mean, that's scathing. That hurts. That hurts even now to be reading stuff like that. And I read chapter 1, I think, okay, well, maybe chapter 2 will get a little bit better. So I get into chapter 2, and I say, "Is it the duty of the priest to teach the true knowledge of God? People should go to them to learn my will, because they are the messengers of the Lord Almighty. But now you priests have turned away from the right path. Your teaching has led many to do wrong. You have broken the covenant I made with you, so I, in turn, will make the people of Israel despise you, because you do not obey my will. And when you teach my people, you do not treat everyone alike. Don't we all have the same Father? Didn't the same God create us all? Then why do we break our promises to one another? And why do we despise the covenant that God made with our ancestors?" Even in chapter 2, we find God in this back and forth questioning. One of those unique things to the book of Malachi, as God asks questions and the people answer back. We find God is still just tearing them apart. And so I think, okay, we'll get into chapter 3. Maybe chapter 3 will be a little bit better. It says that "I am the Lord, and I do not change. And so you, the descendants of Jacob, are not yet completely lost. You, like your ancestors before you, have turned away from my laws and have not kept them. Turn back to me, and I will turn to you. But you ask, 'What must we do to turn back to you?' I ask you, is it right for a person to cheat God? Of course not, yet you are cheating me. How, you ask? In the matter of tithes and offerings, a curse is on all of you because the whole nation is cheating me." I'm looking, as I read this book, for the happy ending, for the point where God just says, "Oh, you know, just playing." But it never comes. Even when you get into chapter 4, God is just letting the people of Israel have it over and over and over again. I mean, this doesn't sound like a group of people that is pleasing to God, does it? I mean, as I'm reading these chapters, I can't think of, man, what did they do to mess up? Even though some of them have started making this pilgrimage back to Jerusalem, here in the city of God, the city of David, and they're still messing up, they're still not getting it right. And it's also interesting to me that these people don't seem to know it, do they? They don't seem to have a clue, absolutely clueless to what's going on. Because as God is asking them these questions or telling them what they're doing, they're saying, "Well, God, how did we do that? When did we do that? I don't remember doing that. How did we get so far away from you? How are we cheating you?" They're robbing God, and they don't even know it. They just keep going through the motions every day, offering the same old sacrifices, saying the same old prayers, singing the same old songs. They're not doing it with any joy. They're not giving the best of what they have, not like God asked them to, are they? They're not really sacrificing, are they? I mean, they're sacrificing, yes, but they're not really sacrificing. But in their minds, they're saying, "God, we gave you sacrifices. Isn't that enough? That's what you asked for. That's what you wanted from us, isn't it?" But God looks at them and he says, "You robbed me. Because you're not offering the sacrifices that I asked you to, the way that I asked you to do it, you're robbing me." And in chapter 1, I love that he says, I wish that somebody would shut the gates. You know what gates he's talking about? Shut the gates of the temple so that you can't come in and light the fires to offer these sacrifices to me, that you can't come into the temple anymore and worship me. It would be better if you couldn't do that than doing what you're doing right now. That hurts, doesn't it? I can't imagine, as an Israelite, having the God that I say that I worship calling me a robber, or having God wish that I couldn't worship Him anymore. I mean, that's like the knife in the back or the knife through the heart for a worshiper of God, for someone who follows God. And the more and more I read this, the more times I read it, the more that I started thinking about it, I thought, you know what? These people sound a little bit like what we might call lukewarm, don't they? You know, that lukewarm Christian. But that's kind of a weird word, isn't it? Lukewarm. I remember when I was a little kid, the first time I heard that, I thought, what in the world? It's not a word that we use a lot these days. It's not used very often. So I went to the dictionary, actually dictionary.com. I don't even look in a real paper dictionary anymore. But I got the dictionary out, and I started looking, and it says that it means moderately warm. I'm like, okay. If we reference that back to the food like we were talking about earlier, I don't like a casserole that's partially heated. You know, I like it to be all the way heated so that I know that the chicken or whatever is in there isn't going to poison me. So moderately warm, that doesn't sound like a very good thing to me. And then the very next definition was this. It says having or expressing little enthusiasm or conviction. I don't know about you, but that seems to be a good definition for what we read from the people of Israel here in the book of Malachi, isn't it? When we turn to the Bible, we look at it this way from Revelation chapter 3. We're all pretty familiar with these verses. But God says to the church at Laodicea, I know what you have done. I know that you are neither hot or cold. How I wish that you were either one or the other. But because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I'm going to spit you out of my mouth. You say, I am rich and well off. I have all that I need. But you don't know how miserable and pitiful that you are. You are poor, naked, and blind. There's nothing very nice or very sweet in these verses, is there? There's nothing very appetizing about the picture of being spit out of someone's mouth, if we think about the times in our lives when we actually have to spit stuff out, is there? We don't like to be called miserable. I mean, I don't feel like I live a very miserable life, but here God is telling the people that they're miserable and that they're pitiful. He looks down on them and says, guys, you're just missing it. You're poor and you're naked and you're blind, even when you think that you have it all. I don't know about you, but when I read these verses, it doesn't sound like folks that are going to heaven, does it? It doesn't sound like somebody that I am going to meet on the other side of those pearly gates, which hopefully I'll get there myself. But it doesn't sound like these people are going to be there, does it? But yet, when many of us talk about these verses, we talk about them as those lukewarm Christians from Laodicea, don't we? To which I offer this question, is there such thing as a lukewarm Christian? That Christian who is kind of straddling the fence, who isn't really hot or cold, they're not on fire for God, but they're not really turned off to Him, they're just kind of there, kind of straddling the fence, trying to do a little bit of both. I don't think so. The more I read the Bible, the more I'm convinced that there is absolutely no such thing as a lukewarm Christian. You can't be right there in the middle. You can't play that middle of the road. You're either for Him or you're against Him. You know, when I read the words of Jesus as He's talking to us about the rich young ruler and the young man that comes to Him and says, you know, I've been doing all of these things. What would you have me do? He says, I want you to go sell everything. Give it to the poor and follow me. And what does the guy do? He says, all right, yeah, I can do that. He goes away sad, doesn't he? Because he wanted both. He wanted to have all of his money, but he also wanted to be able to get to heaven. He wanted to be able to be with Jesus in those last days. He was proud of what he had worked for, proud of what he had in this life and what he had accomplished in his life. And Jesus saw that. He saw that in his soul. And because of that, I think that's why he challenged him right here. He says, all right, that's what you're most proud of. That's what I want you to give up, because that's what it takes to truly and honestly follow me with all of your heart. You've got to give it up. He makes it an all or nothing proposition for this man. He's like, you give it all up, or, you know, you're not going to be in heaven with me. Sorry. When I read his parable of the soils, especially as a younger kid, well, I thought to myself, oh, I wonder in this story who is saved. I mean, is the guy, the seed that landed in the on the thorny ground, is he saved? I mean, he had roots, didn't he? He had the roots to begin with and then got choked out. What about the guy who landed on the rocks? He didn't have roots, but he did grow a little bit. I mean, are those people saved? These are the people that, if by our definitions, would be considered lukewarm, aren't they? These people that, as I stand in front of you, I honestly can't say that I don't think that they're going to heaven. But somehow we've convinced ourselves that being lukewarm is okay. It's okay to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that. It's okay to have everything that we want in this world and a little bit of God on the side. It's like when you go to the cafeteria and you're like, I want this, 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 this. We want it all. We want everything that this world has to offer, everything that we can possibly get here, but we also want to go to heaven. And we say all of this in the same sentence. We manage to put all kinds of things ahead of being here in this building, and even ahead of God in general in our lives. Our jobs. Our schoolwork. Not that it's not important. The extracurricular activities that we're involved in sometimes all take precedence before it gets to saying our prayers at night or reading our Bibles before we go to bed or when we get up in the morning. All of what we term as busyness or life, we let get in the way of serving our God. We come to preachers and ministers and we ask them questions like, do I really have to go to church? Can I divorce my wife and still go to heaven? Do I really have to be baptized to be saved? Am I a Christian even though I'm having sex with my girlfriend? It's as if we're searching for the absolute bare minimum level of commitment and still be a Christian and still go to heaven. We're just like that rich young ruler, aren't we? We want to be sure that we make it to heaven because, you know, that just wouldn't be acceptable for somebody who calls themselves a Christian, would it? We want to be sure we make it to heaven, but we're not really sure that we want to put in all of the effort and make all of the sacrifices that it's going to take to get there. Is that how we think? I hope that's not how we think. We want to go to heaven without having to change very much about ourselves, about the way that we live, because if most of us were completely honest with ourselves, we're asked to give up very little in this world for Christ, aren't we? We haven't had to sacrifice very much in our lives in the name of our Lord and Savior, have we? Because being a Christian doesn't stop us from having a nice house, does it? It doesn't stop us from having that garden in the backyard. It doesn't stop us from having a nice car. It doesn't stop us from having kids. It doesn't keep us from having jobs that take us places in this world. It doesn't keep us from having good grades. We have all of these things, all of this stuff going on in our lives. And God would never hold us back from these things, would He? He would never say, you know what? I can't let you have that. You don't need that. Because God is a good God. He is a gracious God. And He gives to us freely. And that's the reason that we have all of the stuff that we have. But for some reason, all of those things seem to hold us back from following after Him with everything that we have. All of the stuff in our lives, all of the stuff that God has given us, keep us from following Him. When we turn to Matthew chapter 16, we read this. It says that if any of you want to come with me, you must forget yourself. Carry your cross and follow me. For if you want to save your own life, you will lose it. But if you lose your life for my sake, you will find it. We read in Luke that none of you can be my disciple unless you give up everything you have. And again in Romans chapter 12. So then, my friends, because of God's great mercy to us, I appeal to you, offer yourselves a living sacrifice to God, dedicated to His service and pleasing to Him. This is the true worship that you should offer. I don't know about you, but these three verses, and there's others, these are just three that I picked out. But these verses clearly speak to me that God wants it all. He wants everything. He deserves and demands our best, not just our half-hearted commitment. He's been clear from the very beginning that some sacrifices are acceptable to Him and some aren't. Just ask Cain, whose sacrifice was accepted by God. We read in Hosea chapter 13 and verse 6, that but when you entered the good land, you became full and satisfied, and then you grew proud, and you forgot me. I gave you all of this, everything that you have, I brought you to it. And once you were there, you forgot about me. You forgot to leave time for me, to make time for me, to make me a priority in your life. It's easy to give God the leftovers, to fill up our lives with everything else that we've got going on, because let's face it, we could fill up our time with a lot of stuff if we really try hard. But He deserves more than just our guilty sacrifices, doesn't He? Leftovers and hand-me-downs are completely inadequate when it comes to our lives and following God. If it wasn't good enough in Malachi's day, it certainly isn't good enough for us today. And we've got to make a change in our lives. I know I'm probably as guilty as anybody in this. I've got to make a change in my life. We've got to start somewhere, don't we? I'm going to suggest this. I'm going to suggest that we have to start loving. We have to have love in our hearts. We read this in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I may have the gift of inspired preaching. I may have all knowledge and understand all secrets. I may have all the faith needed to move mountains. But if I have no love, I am nothing. I may give away everything I have and even give up my body to be burned. But if I have no love, it doesn't do me any good. These are such strong words, aren't they? So I could be perfect in everything that I do. I can offer all of the sacrifices. I can say all of the right prayers. But if I don't have the love in my heart, it doesn't do me any good. No matter what I do, if I do it without love, we've got nothing there. Paul goes on in chapter 4. I really like this version. It's a little bit different. But it says that love never gives up. Love cares more for others than for self. Love doesn't want what it doesn't have. Love doesn't strut. It doesn't have a swelled head. Doesn't force itself on others. Isn't always me first. Doesn't fly off the handle, doesn't keep score of the sins of others, doesn't revel when others grovel, takes pleasures in the flowering of truth, puts up with anything, trusts God always, always looks for the best, never looks back, but keeps going to the end. This is the love. These are all familiar verses to us, aren't they? Maybe a little bit different. They read a little bit different to you. And because of that familiarity, I think they can be lost sometimes in translation. I want you to try it this way. Everywhere where it says love, I want you to put your name. It would read something like, Bryce never gives up. Bryce cares more for others than for self. And so on down the list. Only, obviously, with your names. When you read that list of qualities, does it sound like qualities that you have in your life? Because this is the love that we're called to as Christians. This is what God calls us to be. Not a love for self, not a love for things, but a love for others, for helping others. This deep love that leads us to our God. It's a little bit sobering, isn't it, when we start comparing ourselves to this list? When we begin to love as God has called us to love, a little self-sacrifice isn't such a big deal after all, is it? Taking just a moment to help somebody out that really could use it isn't such a big deal. Taking a break to say a prayer or to keep up with your daily Bible reading doesn't become such a big deal. It becomes easier and easier to give God the good stuff because that's what He deserves. Because He loves us, He has brought us to everything that we have, and we can't forget about Him. So tonight, I don't know about you. I don't know if you've been giving God the leftovers. But I think it's time to make a change. Excuse me, I can't. Maybe you just need to turn your life around. I love allergies. Maybe you need to turn your life around. Maybe you need to get out of that lukewarm state. I hope that you'll do that tonight. Maybe you need to begin your life with Him, that walk in love that leads you to follow Him with everything that you have. Whatever you need tonight, I pray that we can all learn to give God the good stuff. If there's anything we can do for you tonight, I invite you to come as we stand and sing.